She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say, from my expression that I got maybe in second grade, let's put our thinking caps on, because there's going to be lots to think about for the content of this show. And as always, I'd like to mention that our show is made possible due to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group. They sell some of the most fuel-efficient cars on the market today, and they are strong community partners in causes they believe in, Mrs. Green's World being one of them. Please visit them at ChapmanTucson.com to learn more. Thank you, Chapman. So everybody, what another great content-rich show we have lined up for all of us today. The name of our show is Ecosystems Genomics, Studying the Earth's DNA. And get ready, we are going to learn things. It can be translated into mainstream English. We are just thrilled to have as our guest for this hour, Matthew Sullivan, who is, are you ready, everybody? Assistant Professor, Departments of Microbiology and Civil, Environmental, and Geodetic Engineering, Ohio State, and is also the co-founder of the Ecosystems Genomics Institute at the University of Arizona. Matt, welcome to Mrs. Green's World, and thanks for saying yes to being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's so funny. If I say anything wrong, because, you know, genomics, if that's mispronounced, this is Mrs. Green's World. You can say, really, Gina, that's actually said this way, because I'm not an expert on any of those pronunciations, but I do my best. And for everything else, there's Google. So,
that's
Matt,
great.
Yeah, so the ocean is indeed the largest ecosystem on Earth. And I don't know if people think about that. I really don't. From doing many interviews and lots of my research, my observation is that we still seem to know very little about this vital ecosystem. We know like a drop when you think of the ocean. So that I'm glad you're here to change all that in an hour, no less. No pressure. So let's begin with your background and your life's work and what brought you to studying ocean viruses, and take as much time as you need, because now it's all about you.
Okay. Well, I guess it started sort of being the typical Midwest environmental geek, really, making cloth lunch bags in high school and trying to save the earth in my ecology club. And my folks had the crazy idea from the Midwest to drive down to Florida every summer, because, you know, that's when you want to be in Florida. But we just spent all this time on the beach and in the water and picking up shells and recognizing all these organisms that were there. And that's when I really decided I had a passion for the oceans, and took the leap of going to a little tiny marine biology school, Southampton College on Long Island, because it was right across from the ocean.
Wow, I know that college. I'm a Jersey girl. And
oh,
I've actually
great.
Met people from that college. So yes, a very rich place to study in terms of the availability of ocean life.
And a lot of marine biologists have gone through there. It actually is a really amazing place to learn marine biology, because they are so good at training you with hands-on experiences, getting you out to observe the real world. When I was there, I actually was inspired early on by a seaweed ecologist, someone who studied algae, the stuff that usually makes people slip on rocks when they're walking around the intertidal zone. And I really got to do neat experiences in Chesapeake Bay, scuba diving in California kelp forests, looking at how seaweeds changed with and without wave action. I sailed around in the Caribbean on a schooner for 9 weeks, learning about all the Caribbean marine ecosystems that exist. And that obviously is an easy way to fall in love with ecology.
Right.
And the study of how organisms interact.
Right.
And then I kind of got surprised. I went to Scripps Institution of Oceanography for a summer.
Wow.
And Dr. Brian Palinick was my mentor, and he said, I want you to, during this research experience, use viruses as a way to label a protein on a cell surface. And this was a really important sort of biotechnological leap for us to try. I actually was pretty poor in the actual application. But what I did that summer is I read a lot about viruses in the oceans, and that's when I realized it seemed like at that point we knew there were a lot of them, but we didn't know anything. And I thought, if something's out there in big numbers, it's probably doing something important. So that's really how I became full circled from oceans and seaweeds to studying viruses.
You know, from Ted Danson, who helped start Oceana, and his buddy Andy Sharpless, to our dear friend Rafe Sagarin that we talked about off-air a little bit, and we all miss him so very much, and other guests that I've had on whose specific mission in life is to study oceans, I can't believe how many of their stories began in tide pools and just being in the ocean. I mean, a lot of great minds started churning by just really having access to playing in the ocean, and brings up how important it is to get yourself and your children and your families exposed to our vast ocean. So that was a little sidebar I had to go off on.
Sure. One point that Rafe made very strongly during his interview with you, which is just beautiful to hear the other day as I was sort of preparing, a big point Rafe made, and I think gets underappreciated, is we've just got to go out and observe. And it's only observing these complex systems that we can begin to think about how nature solved problems that we might need to solve problems in our normal society. So I think Rafe really had it spot on. Get out there and see things. Observe.
He did. And we're all going to keep on his important work. We're going to keep on keeping on. It's just unbelievable how much one man made a difference in the lives of so many. What a footprint. There's things planned coming up for the U of A, and just tributes to him now that the Institute of the Environment is opening their new building. So it's great. But let's make this really about you more. And I'm glad we did take the time to honor Rafe. So the way that I heard about you and your work was in, it was in a U of A news release in May. And I, you know, I'm a Wildcat, I'm an alumni. And I read the article and I said to Kelly, we have got to get this man on the show. So I just want to do a short quote because I think it sets the tone for a lot of the rest of the interview. New insights into drivers of Earth's ecosystems. Hidden among Earth's vast oceans are some of the tiniest and most vital organisms to the health of delicate ecosystems. Ocean microbes produce half of the oxygen we breathe and are important drivers in chemical reactions and energy transfers that fuel critical ecological processes. And I emphasized half the oxygen we breathe because to our listeners and to me, this is why it's important. This is why I want you to tell us what you are doing and why are studying viruses so important.
Yeah, I usually sort of ask someone to take a breath and then to take a second breath and say that second one was a gift from the ocean.
The ocean, I love that.
We're only sort of beginning to recognize who in the ocean even is providing that oxygen. For example, in my PhD, the organism that I studied is a tiny photosynthetic cell called Prochlorococcus, and that was discovered by Penny Chisholm at MIT in 1989 only because they took a really expensive laser instrument out to sea and saw some sort of particles they didn't recognize. The same's true with viruses. It feels like every time we look, there's something really new and interesting happening. The work with my PhD was with Prochlorococcus viruses, and that's a photosynthetic cell. What we observed was that these viruses actually encode photosynthesis genes. It's not that a virus can do photosynthesis by itself, but it has found a way to interact with its cell so that when it takes the cell over, it makes sure that all the machinery it's going to need to make more viruses is there. And so at any given time, about a third of the cells in the oceans are infected by a virus, and many of those that are photosynthetic are photosynthesizing and producing that oxygen we need using viral proteins.
I get it. I want to ring the bell. I get it. So keep going.
Well, I think a lot of times I'll say most people are familiar with viruses in humans, particularly this time of year as flu season approaches, and those are the viruses that infect your body's cells. But actually, in your body, there's 10 times more microbial cells, and there's, of course, viruses that infect those microbial cells, and we don't really know much about them, but they're likely important. For example, microbial toxins that we think of, like cholera toxin or Shiga toxin or pertussis toxin, actually it's a virus in that microbe that encodes those toxin genes. And I love this layering and connectedness of life. You know, a virus encodes a gene for the microbe to interact with its host. Here, virus, microbe, human are the interactions we're studying, but it could easily be virus, microbe, and a copepod or some small animal in the oceans.
So is it safe to say, like, are all viruses bad? I know that sounds really, really... it seems
no, we get this all the time.
Okay. So I didn't want to say it sounded like a stupid question, but most people think, oh God, she got a virus, or I got a virus, or I have a virus. So in this particular case, it's really part of the texture and the makeup of life.
Yeah, it's part of the ecosystem. You know, the next time you go swimming in the ocean and you swallow seawater, you've just swallowed 50 million viruses. Don't worry, they're not going to infect you.
That's really very encouraging, Matt. Thank you.
They infect ocean microbes.
Oh
they don't infect anything. You know, there's so many of these viruses, 50 million in a mouthful of seawater. There's 10 to the 30 on the planet. And to put that kind of a big number in perspective, if you stuck viruses, which of course we can't see and are incredibly tiny, but if you stuck them end to end, there's so many of them, they would measure many, many, many light years away from Earth. So this is a huge biomass. 98% of the biomass in the ocean is actually small cells and viruses.
50 million in a swallow from the ocean?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to remember to keep my mouth closed the next time I go swimming. That's note to self. Okay, so back on track. One of the things that really surprised me in doing the, you know, going down the rabbit hole of this research for the show, and it was kind of like walking into a door that got closed and you didn't know it, or I don't know what analogy to do. Given that the oceans are so vitally important to our survival, why do we know so little about them? And what makes studying them in nature so challenging? Because there isn't a lot. You hear about, you know, preserving species and habitat devastation and dead zones. But in terms of really studying the oceans and the viruses, why isn't there more? What makes that so challenging?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think there's two major reasons studying viruses in any complex environment in nature or the oceans is hard. The first one is they're hard to culture. You can't grow a virus without a host. And it turns out we can't grow host cells very well at all. In fact, our record suggests that we're something like less than 10% or less than 1% able to do that. So we have no idea how badly we're doing for viruses, except that, there's 54 big types of bacteria that are known. They're called phyla. And of these, almost all the viruses we've sequenced to date, in fact, three out of those 54 types. So we've got 51 other types of microbes to go out there and try to find viruses for it. So that's how bad we're doing with culturing. The second big issue is...
And is it, let me just interrupt, is it just culturing from the oceans? Because there's other kind of culturing that goes on in other research. Is it because they are in the water that makes it so challenging? Does that question make sense?
Yes, yeah. It's probably because we don't know what they need to live.
Okay.
And in many cases, they might need each other to live. And our model to culture things is usually to get them clonal and by themselves.
Right, isolate.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that where we've been successful in environments, soils or oceans, it's been using some more difficult tricks, like don't give them a lot of nutrients, because actually they've evolved for billions of years in the middle of the ocean to have almost no nutrients. So you actually potentially hurt them if you flood them with normal media. So
I get it. I really get it. And I think that one of the things is, like I said, this will not be a linear interview. Not that any of my interviews are linear, because when you have whirling dervish brain and an insatiable curiosity, things pop up. But I think we should tell people about the ship. Like, I had a vision of this was a 5-year, 10-year mission, and they've been out on the sea, and I'm thinking this big, like, submarine-like vessel. You guys did a lot of work, and I looked at the picture of this vessel tell us about the vessel. It was not that big.
That's right.
For such big stuff to be going on. I mean, people want to get a visual. OMG.
Yeah, typically you want to bring a lot of fancy equipment to see when you're studying the oceans, and that requires some space and some stable electricity, for example. And those are big ships. And the ship that this four-year global oceanographic expedition was done on is a sailboat. It's a good-sized sailboat, but it's a sailboat. A wonderful sailboat that's been used in many ways for science now and scientific education. But this is a boat that's, you wouldn't put more than 12 people on it at a time, and that's crowded.
Man, I looked at it, and I'm thinking sleeping for 12? It was a shock to me because of the vast amount of research and the results that you produced, given that that was your host vessel, so to speak. It was really, I encourage people to take a look at it. All you have to do is Google Terra Oceans Expedition, and the beautiful picture of it comes up right by the Statue of Liberty, which I thought was really great. it's rather shocking. And then can we share with everyone, I want to get into more of the research, but how long did each people spend on the ocean? And did you do deep diving, or what was the actual physical opportunity for people? Did you have to go out to sea for 6 months? Did you have to do deep diving? Were you looking for particular types of viruses that are only on the ocean floor? That was six questions, but you can start with number one. How long did you have to go out with it?
it was a rotation set up, and there were 5 to 7 scientists on the boat at any given time for about a month.
Okay, so that's doable.
And those numbers varied depending actually on how much public relations folks were on board, because a strong effort was to film this adventure. And there are documentaries about it and incredible clips and footage. But these people would be out for about a month, and they would learn it all on the job. And when they were done, they would overlap and train the next group of scientists. And these are postdocs, graduate students, and professors from the 200 or so scientists that were involved in the project that came from 35 different countries, 20 different specialities. It was truly a global, it takes a village kind of effort.
Wow, no kidding.
To keep the boat stocked and get samples.
No kidding. And what was your entree into the ability to be a part of the study? I mean, you know what I mean? How did you and your team get picked or have the possibility to be participating in this important research?
Yeah, I would say if Jacques Cousteau were alive today, this would have been his expedition. He would have led this.
And, wow.
It's because these plankton that we were studying, these organisms, which are small enough, they just sort of are at the prey of the currents. They float in the oceans. They don't really move against the current. These plankton are so magical and undiscovered, but the tools we have today, both the sequence data, which we've touched on a bit, and the imaging capacity, which was also part of these studies, are just off scale and allow us to see organisms in ways that you couldn't hope to see. In fact, there's actually now a coffee table book that Christian Sardé, one of the coordinators on the project, put together called Plankton. If you want to see just image after image of organisms Dr. Seuss would be proud of, you want to check this book out. For me, it started at a conference in Monaco in 2008. I was there for a biotechnology conference between the U.S. and EU, and Dr. Chris Bowler had just presented what I would call was the dream of Terra Oceans, because it was just a dream at that point.
Right.
And this idea was, can we study everything smaller than fish larvae globally? And he really neglected viruses. And that was completely understandable to leave out viruses at that time, because viruses were really newly thought to be important. But outside of a few examples, like the cyanobacterial photosynthesis virus story I shared earlier, we had very few ways of studying them more broadly. Fortunately, I gave a talk a couple slots later saying our new ways we were studying ocean viruses, and Dr. Bowler came up and said, hey, would you be interested in joining this team of coordinators? And I was a brand new faculty member. I had startups, so I was able to do whatever I wanted.
Oh my gosh,
globally, how cool would that be? So, of course, I
said, hey, back. And Matt, you're not going to believe this. We are up on our first break. I told you the time was going to fly. And I know that everybody is going to want to stay right here with us. Our guest for this hour is Matthew Sullivan, Assistant Professor, Departments of Microbiology, Civil and Environmental and Geodetic Engineering at Ohio State, and co-founder of Ecosystems Genomics Institute, Institute at the U of A. Everybody, stay here with me. Lots more questions, lots more great answers. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And such exciting information to think about today, our oceans, our vast, blessed oceans. Our guest for this hour is Matthew Sullivan. He is Assistant Professor, Departments of Microbiology and Civil Environmental and Geodetic Engineering at Ohio State, and also co-founder of the Ecosystems Genomics Institute at the University of Arizona. And Matt, when we last spoke about 60 seconds ago, you were talking about a young in your career, early in your career, this tremendous opportunity to be a part of Terra Oceans. So let's go on with that. And what happened after you went to that conference in, Morocco?
In Monaco.
It was one of those great places I haven't gotten to visit yet. So it was Monaco. Beautiful, beautiful place. Yeah. Lucky you. Okay.
Well,
it became
very practical, to be honest. Fortunately, I guess for me, I got to fly to France a lot, where the group that was really leading this project were based. And we had to talk about the details of how do we put sampling equipment to study viruses to fish larvae on a sailboat. How do we staff it with people, and how do we even get the water we need? You know,
right.
So it was horse trading to get the volumes of water you need, and imagine the boat getting to a station and spending 60 hours trying to sample what are the few things that each of our teams would need to be able to talk to each other about how these ecosystems worked,
and then build the bridge for us to how it got from Ohio State and you to the University of Arizona. Connect that dot for us.
Well, I was a new faculty at the University of Arizona,
which is why
I started the Ecosystem Genomics Institute there. Yeah, and so I spent 7.5 great years at this innovative place called the U of A.
I know.
That's where I was new faculty, and that's where I really learned how to get started. So that was the connection. I was studying, of course, the global oceans from the deserts of Arizona, which I get teased for all the time, as you can imagine.
It is like Rafe building an ocean project at Biosphere 2. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's really, really important.
We had to develop new technologies to even sample the viruses, because, again, we had a 1x2 footprint to put all our equipment. That was in a filtering house on the back deck of a boat that held 3 people and all the wet lab filtering we could do. We had to go to the drawing board again and reinvent how we'd sample these viruses. And we developed that before Rafe got involved in the Biosphere Ocean. We developed that in the Biosphere Ocean. That was my local ocean. That's
yes.
where I went to develop these methods.
Oh, my gosh. Thus, highlighting the importance of Biosphere 2. I mean,
yes.
Joaquin will be so proud of us that we gave that a shout-out.
That's right.
He has said on my show his biggest worry, so we have to help that grow. But one of the quotes that I came upon is really great, and you can expand upon this. The Terra Oceans Expedition provided a platform for systematically sampling ocean biota, and I hope I said that right, from viruses to fish larvae, and in a comprehensive environmental context. Until now, a global picture of ocean viral community patterns and ecological drivers was something we could only dream of achieving. Okay, so that's the dream that you get to be a part of. What does that look like? What do you have to do to sample plankton? Like, literally tell us what you have to do, because this is not TV. You can't walk over to the ocean and show us. What do you have to do? Just take a drop?
Well, you know, you've seen those pictures from, like, the moon or from outer space of Earth, and that someone who might draw the flow of the oceans on top of that. So there's this large-scale circulation, right, moving around the Earth all the time in the oceans. And then you've also, when you see those pictures of plankton under a microscope, they're swarming around, and this is incredibly dynamic. So how do you capture that? And worse, how do you capture that from this sailboat rocking back and forth? So imagine yourself, again, trying to pull up tens of liters at a time. You haul those across a wet deck to put them on some filtering apparatus.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's 60 hours at a time where you're getting probably 5 hours whenever you need it kind of sleep on a rocking ship processing samples. And that's the lucky people, because there's also people down below in the dry lab that are actually sitting in front of computers and laser instruments and microscopes that are fancy, and they're trying to look at things, you know, as the boat's moving back. Imagine you're reading your computer screen on a moving boat.
No, I can't. It's making me sick right even now thinking about it. Like, I'm
so before any of that, we started, like I say, for a couple of years just talking about how much water do you need? Can you use a tenth of that? Right? How much time do you need? Can you get away with a fifth of that? You know, so I think every one of us had to invent these new methods to even begin to ask simple questions like, what viruses are out there?
It's a new frontier. I mean, that's what I think about. I start want to play Star Wars music, and I'm not kidding. It's like you're on a new frontier in a whole new world, and it's the oceans. It's rather shocking for how long they have been giving us life and air that this, you know, monumental study started not so very long ago. That's, you know, more of a comment than a question, but how exciting for you to be involved in it. And then I might
just add in too, and I appreciate the oxygen one. I think another thing that gets overlooked is as we humans put 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you know, we've got to thank the oceans, because the oceans actually absorb half of that. You know, that's the other major thing the oceans are doing for us right now. It's not just giving us the air we breathe, but it's also making sure we don't warm our planet or change our planet's climate too quickly. And the oceans really pay for that. You know, it turns out in the ocean, as they absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, there's actually a chemistry which acidifies the oceans as a result of that. The carbon uptake is linked to acidification. And we, as humans, have successfully acidified the ocean 30% since pre-industrial times, at rates 100 times faster than has ever been observed in the last 100 million years. So thank you, oceans, for keeping us really buffered against the impacts we're making. But boy, this is a really important reason to make sure we get a sense for how the microbes and plankton impact that carbon buffering capacity, because that's a major player.
And I know that you said we are going to get to this, but I'm going to leave it to the last segment about why you're so excited and happy and upbeat, because ocean acidification is daunting and depressing, and it's wiping out lots of species. And I want to be hope, possibility, and change. So I think it's really interesting that, you know, there really is a lot of bad news. And to me, when I spoke with you, it's so important that you're focusing on the good news and solutions. And that's, you know, we want to get to that. But let's have a little more meat and content, and not end on any note about ocean acidification.
Okay.
Other than people can really be a part of the change. That's what the show is about. Okay. And then did I ask you this? Why plankton? Of all things that you could study, I really don't think I asked you why plankton.
Sure. You know, plankton are the base of the food web, and the first organisms to take in sunlight and turn that into energy and biomass that feeds up the food chain. So plankton are the basis of, you know, the fisheries that we have off our coasts. They're the basis of whales, sharks, dolphins getting any food, and they're the basis of this oxygen that we breathe and moving that carbon that gets into the ocean into forms that can be good or bad. And so we were interested in plankton as specialists because, you know, I fell in love with viruses for my reasons. And the bacteria person loves bacteria for their reasons, and the, you know,
I don't know how I'm going to hashtag that. I fell in love with viruses. I might really tarnish your reputation. It's like, uh-oh, this guy fell in love with viruses. Somebody else fell in love with bacteria. And I think they're called scientists. And we thank heaven for you guys. But that's pretty funny, Matt. Okay, so I understand why plankton. And it's a microcosm of everything else. And I think it's interesting that you weren't studying anything about devastation, but more just the science of what it is. Okay, we're going to at some point have to start about, I believe that five landmark studies were born from your Tara Ocean science research. And if that's not correct, tell me. And if it is, start, hit me with your best shot. Tell me about some of these things and what papers were published. And I think you can go into as much detail as you want.
Okay. Yes, the May PR feed that you first found out about was actually in response to five papers that were published in a special issue of Science dedicated to this Tara Oceans expedition.
Which is a fabulous article and helped me so much. Just having that link to that
right.
article was really helpful. So, but you have to tell it because I can't.
Right. So these five papers, three of them, you could imagine are studying really what is diversity of viruses, microbes, which are bacteria and archaea, so the small things, and then the eukaryotes. And eukaryotes in our world that we think of are lions and tigers and plants. So all the big stuff you normally think of. So those three papers really are kind of the diversity and ecology of those groups. So I'll just walk through those one at a time.
I would love that.
So the first paper, we'll start with the eukaryotes. These are the plants and animals of the oceans, if you will. It's the ones that are smaller than fish larvae because dolphins didn't swim into our nets. But what we did try sampling those in many, many different ways. And the challenge in studying eukaryotes was that they didn't have a barcode gene readily designed to be able to measure diversity.
Wow.
And so that was the first thing they did, is they said, well, what would be a good gene to target, and how can we do that in a way that leverages modern sequencing? And so once they had figured that out, they have this global map now of eukaryotic diversity, and I'll just throw out some of the more salient facts. There's a lot of neat things in the paper, but the first one is there's probably about 150,000 types or species that were observed in the surface oceans, and that's pretty much a number we've saturated. You know, really gotten to where we think we're seeing most, if not all, of the eukaryotes. This is a lot. This is a big number because only 11,000 have been described.
Wow.
So it's a tenfold increase. The second kind of interesting thing is that a lot of things were expected. You know, we saw diversity in groups like diatoms, which are the glass floating plants of the sea.
Okay.
But we also saw a lot of surprises. For example, most of the diversity was in the smallest eukaryotes. And when we looked more carefully, it turned out it was because there was a lot of these partnerships where the small eukaryote would partner with a bigger eukaryote, or one of these microbes would partner with a bigger eukaryote. And that's called symbiosis, where two organisms will live together. And that was certainly known, and we know of many examples in the oceans, but I think that there were so many examples of symbioses in the plankton. And again, these are the floating organisms in the water column. So we didn't study the sediments, and we didn't study surface. This is all floating organisms in the water column.
And it's really, I want people, we have a lot of scientists that listen, and they're listening to Mrs. Green's World while they're running and getting their exercise. And a eukaryote, it's actually spelled with an E-U, correct?
E-U-K-A-R-Y-O-T-E. That's right.
Okay. Uh-huh. I just think it's a hard word, and I'm glad you brought it up. It's not common vernacular for most people in their conversation.
Right.
Okay. So go ahead.
So the second paper studied what we would sometimes call the prokaryotes, although that name is under fire. And so these are essentially what we typically think of as microbes, bacteria, and archaea. And so these are single-celled organisms that are simpler than the eukaryotes.
And why is it under fire?
Do you really want to go into this?
Maybe not.
It turns out that...
Hold, please. No, next question.
it turns out when you try to reconstruct the tree of life, it's really difficult to understand those really, really old relationships.
That might be another show.
There's some controversy. There could be a whole other show. In fact, Mike Sanderson at the U of A is a great person to have on for a show about the tree of life. But trying to understand those deep evolutionary relationships is difficult, and so that's a little under fire. So that second paper, which is about these bacteria and these archaea, or often when you hear the word microbiome, this is what people are talking about.
Okay.
It's usually just bacteria, but if there's archaea around, for example, when there's low oxygen, there's a lot more archaea around, then they'll also be part of the microbiome.
Okay.
So this paper, again, studied the microbiome now globally in the surface oceans, and also had some deep ocean samples. And unlike the first study, they didn't just sequence a barcode gene. They collected the organisms and then sequenced everything.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is what we would call community genomics or metagenomics. You're just saying, I'm going to try to sequence everything. And what's neat about that is it lets you not only say something about what organisms are there, but it lets you talk about the functions that they might be doing. And so what we learned is that in the global oceans, there's probably about 40 million microbial genes, and this includes viruses, by the way.
40 million
genes. But again, saturated, meaning as we sampled more and more, we're not really getting new types. And to me, that's exciting because we're bounding the problem here. 40 million may sound like a lot, but the projections were higher. So so we're excited it's only 40 million. And are these new genes? Actually, 80% of them were new. And when you went deeper in the ocean, up to 90% were new. So a lot more novelty deeper in the ocean. That's probably
so new in terms of what you were discovering and getting to study about.
New in terms of when you tried to figure out what a gene that you could see in your data set was, it was completely new to science.
Oh, my gosh.
We didn't know what it was doing. Yeah.
So I just want to, this is another little sidebar. So, like, I'm listening as Mrs. Green, mainstream, caring deeply about the planet. But from the view of a scientist, was there the equivalent of, like, oh, my gosh, look at this. Look what we're finding. And a lot of conversation about the excitement for this new journey. I mean, it's a whole new world that you were finding. Is that an overstatement?
Oh, sure. And I think this is the kind of data sets. These are the data sets that, you know, many specialists for the next 10 years can just have a playground opportunity to just study all kinds of things. I can't even dream what they're going to learn from these data. And, you know, even though there's 200 scientists involved in these first five papers, we're really the tip of the iceberg just with these data. And I didn't mention this, but these five papers are written about 579 samples from 210 stations around the world's oceans. And those 579 samples are only a fraction of the 35,000 that we have. So this data set generated from a tip of the iceberg of the samples is just the tip of the iceberg.
It's massive. I mean, it really is. It's massive. It really and truly is. And there were, I forget how many people on your team. Were there four other people on your team or three?
That's right. A number of people worked on things, but it was four major people within my group. Yeah, worked on this.
So, and they were the ones on the ship. Yes. Okay, so we have number one and number two. What was number three paper?
Well, I might, on number two, there's two more facts I'll mention.
Okay.
That there were 35,000 types of organisms, species, if you will, that were discovered. That's, just to give you context, that's four times more than is in the human gut. And interestingly, the kinds of microbes that grew together, if you knew that, you could tell the temperature very well. It turned out that temperature was such a strong driver of community structure, you could actually design a microbial thermometer. It'd be pretty expensive. You probably wouldn't want to tell temperature this way, but it was very predictive.
But somebody will do it now.
I know. Great.
It really will. It's like, come on, let's do it.
If there's a good use for it.
Put it out there. So impressive. Okay, and I'm taking notes while you're doing this because I like to get, like, I try to get sound bites that we can put on for Twitter so that people really, I mean, it really is important to get shows like this out there. You have to capture the masses' attention. Sometimes I feel like a polywog in the sea of life, believe me. But anyway, we are up on our second break. which just blows my mind. I have lots more questions. Everybody stay here with me, interviewing Matthew Sullivan, assistant professor, departments of microbiology and civil, environmental, and geodetic engineering, Ohio State University. And he is also the co-founder of the Ecosystems Genomics Institute at the University of Arizona. Lots more really fun stuff to learn. Please stay here with us.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, and so much interesting and relevant opportunities for us to think today about the vastness of our oceans and the importance to literally every other breath we take. The name of our show today is Ecosystems Genomics, Studying the Earth's DNA. And as I've said earlier in the hour, our guest is Matthew Sullivan, assistant professor. And I'm not going to say all those departments. There are a lot of departments, and everybody can look it up on my website, but he's doing really big stuff. And I want to do a little take a deep breath and reiterate the importance of people considering becoming members of Mrs. Green's World to sustain us. Later in the show, before we close, I want Matt to talk about how important it was that the people funded the project and how the research was made possible. So even if you're able to do a $5 a month or a $10 a month, let's keep Mrs. Green's World free and independent and be inspired to act. So Matt, I just want to comment that you're a scientist, and this is really deep down important work. And one of the challenges I think science faced is translating the importance and value of the work you do to the public so that we can learn, we can get on board, we can know better and do better. And you're doing a great job, like really and truly hats off to you, to making a very complex research concept even possible. And you're helping. You're doing a great job. So kudos to you. And
thank
if you want, seriously, I mean, this is not everyday stuff that we read about in the that we ever read about in the Arizona Daily Star. Sorry, I mean, but you know, even the New York Times is challenged to cover things like this.
New York Times did actually cover this one.
So send me that link. I mean, and they did an op-ed in their editorial section about microbeads in the ocean last Saturday,
yes,
a week ago. And I was all over that on Facebook and sharing links and talking to the people that I've interviewed about microbeads. So they are on it, and I think trying to absolutely cover more about environmental issues. They should be. Okay.
Absolutely.
So do you
sure
want to say anything more about study number two?
No, I better not. We're running out of time.
Okay, so go on to three. Go.
So study number three is my baby.
Okay, go, go.
So in my lab, again, we study ocean viruses, and I had two postdocs, Simon Rue and Jennifer Brum, as well as a graduate student at the time, now a postdoc, Cesar Ignacio Espinoza, and the three of them co-led, which is pretty rare in science, but the way we had to approach this effort to study these ocean viruses globally required three very different perspectives, and they complemented each other so beautifully in this. It's a testament to them. So in this paper, we were asking simple questions like, what viruses are out there? How many are there? What kinds of genes are out there? And again, I didn't get to talk about this yet, but viruses actually don't share a single gene. So that barcode gene that we used to study eukaryotes or to study microbes, we don't have that. There's not one gene that viruses share across all the viruses. So we looked at viruses in this paper in three ways. One is let's look under a microscope at how viral communities change, and we developed a quantitative method for that. The second was let's take the sequence data and organize it into protein families, if you will.
Okay.
And then we can count at least protein families and know which proteins are more important in one environment or another and do what we call gene or protein ecology. And the third way we looked at them is to take the same sequence space and try to organize it into populations or organisms, if you will, which is always tough to use for viruses. And that was a big advance to even figure out that viral sequence space, if you can visualize variation in sequence space, which most people can't,
right,
is it clustered or not? That's the simple question we had to address. And we found in some previous work that it was clustered. And so that allowed us to draw circles around sections of what we were sequencing from the oceans and talk about populations or organisms or species, if you will. So what did we learn? We found that viruses only encode about 1.4 million genes in the global surface oceans. And so that's a tiny fraction of the microbiome genes. We just mentioned 40 million. These are even more new than the genes we'd seen before. 90% of these were new, and that was common for viral metagenomic studies. And that's, again, because only 3 out of 54 bacterial types do we even have virus sequence data for. And then we also found about half of the genes that could be shared across every viral community, so they were common everywhere in the global oceans, we know nothing about. The fact that genes are scattered all through the global oceans and we can't even tell you what they are is almost embarrassing. Finally, we saw...
It's shocking, actually. It's really shocking. I mean, when I started reading, I'm like, you're right. It's the big divine mystery that what lies beneath.
Right, and how do you begin to think about what these viruses are doing if we can't even talk about what some of their genes are doing that every one of them has in these viral communities? So, and then that third way we looked at them was these populations or types, and we found about 5,476, and I just caution that we only see about 10% of our data with this approach, so we think there's probably tens of thousands of viruses.
Wow.
But we've captured 5,000, and when we looked at those 5,000, only 39 of them are known. So less than 0.1% are we able to say anything
about. I get the numbers. Seriously.
So I think what was nice is that once we had those proteins or populations to study ecology, we were able to do the same sort of comparisons to other things that we measured on the cruise and show that, again, temperature was the best predictor of community structure. And so we're not as good with our viral thermometer as we were with the microbe thermometer, but the temperature is a very strong predictor. And then the other thing we were able to do is we used the oceanography that we knew, meaning we used the currents and how they flowed through the oceans, and we said, where are viral populations moving? And what we learned is that these viral populations we were studying, while we couldn't put a name on them except for 39, we can know that they're now a number. and we were able to show that almost all these viral populations were very widespread, but their abundance at any given site was very different. And usually the virus just seemingly rode the current. So they're produced by some happy microbial host in one environment, grow to high numbers, ride a current into a new environment that's not as good for their host, so their numbers drop.
Okay.
But we could still see them. And so that was a big sort of test of a 10-year-old idea that Maya Breitbart and Forrest Rohwer had put out called the seed bank hypothesis. And this is the idea that everything's everywhere and the environment selects very locally. So that was a fun, real ecological test we were finally able to do with viruses because we had global scale data, but also because we had figured out ways to organize it into units to count.
Now, did the Terra Oceans, was that vessel the one that went everywhere to collect these, or were there other, you know, vessels involved that were sending you samples and data? How did that integrate?
These are all tar oceans.
Gosh.
And so each of the coordinators got 500 to 3,000 or so samples from around the world, sent to them every 3 to 6 months or so. And so I have just unbelievable archives of viruses from around the oceans. And as I mentioned, this study is only 579 out of the 35,000 samples that we all have in our freezers.
That's a good visual. Hopefully not at the house.
Right, no.
Okay. Just a little joke there on Mrs. Green's part.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's so vast. Like, I have to take lots of deep breaths and thank God for the oceans because I have oxygen. But it really is, you know, wide and deep. So keep going because I want you to be every word.
Okay. So those first three papers really, I think, just outlined who are the cast of characters in this play. I mean, this is from viruses to fish larvae, all cases saturating, we think, the kinds of organisms in each of those classes, size classes, that exist in the surface oceans. And so the fourth and fifth papers were a little different. And so the fourth paper said, let's take all these data we have and figure out if we can use statistics and analytics to decide who's interacting with whom. And so
Okay. It's
called the Global Ocean Interactome. I love that name.
The visual
is a hairball of little dots with lines drawn between them when they interact, and it ends up being this hairball mess. But in that hairball, you know, there's 128,000 interactions that were examined. And we're just looking for, you know, does organism A co-occur with organism B? That's an interaction.
Okay.
Right? And so you, of course, do this against a model of what random noise would look like so that you develop statistical significance. And so when you do that and filter out the noise, 128,000 interactions were examined, and these interactions were incredible to just look at. I said, as a specialist, I would look at this and say, basically, do I believe them? And it was so neat because immediately the things that jumped out at you were, oh, of course, Prochlorococcus virus infects the Prochlorococcus host, and we're seeing that co-occurrence, right? But, you know,
of course,
we already
that's
knew
what
that.
You'd say.
Well, we already knew those things. but then what was exciting was there were all these new viruses. You know, we only knew 39 out of 5,476. Well, many of those other 5,476 now had hypothesized partners. This analysis was presenting a hypothesis for who is it that these viruses infect. And that's really powerful because linking a virus to their host in nature, which is so complicated, is hard. It's the holy grail of my field right now. And so this is a great new way to just start to begin to say, okay, 99% of your viruses are new. At least can we ask who do they infect? Or what conditions do they like to live in? And so that's the power of that fourth paper. It's presenting, I would suggest, hypotheses that specialists around the world can test,
right,
depending on their interest. If they're interested in symbioses, which are also another prominent signal, or virus-host interactions, or where organisms live with respect to environments.
Okay, and we have about 7 minutes left. So tell number five.
Okay.
And then I want to give a little bit of a shout out. And I, you know, the last question I hope we can get to is, does all of this help with our ability to avert environmental disaster and the applied, you know, knowledge, how is it's going to help us? Because you are so positive about what you've learned and the predictive models. So go on with number five, and then I just want to be aware of time.
Sure, yes. This fifth paper, it basically was trying to elucidate a real conundrum in oceanography. So off of the tip of South Africa, there's warm, salty water from the Indian Ocean that somehow can mix into the South Atlantic, and
wow,
it spins off in these little vortexes, if you will, into the South Atlantic. And so the question was, do plankton see that as a barrier? In other words, is this a barrier for species to move from one
right
ocean basin to another? And the idea from the old history or the paleoceanography, digging around in sediments, is that, no, it's not a barrier. But what, and very briefly, Tara found was that it is a barrier. When you look at the plankton with low-resolution tools, it doesn't look like a barrier, and that's kind
okay
of all we could do with the existing data. And with these new molecular data, when you look with higher resolution, you could see clearly there's very different groups in the Indian Ocean from the Atlantic Ocean. And further, some beautiful modeling work looked at the drivers. What is it that makes, you know, different plankton want to live in this warm vortex going off in the cold South Atlantic Ocean? And that was really a suite of nutrients which were being brought up, fertilizing, if you will, these surface waters that were escaping into the South Atlantic Ocean.
Like, I'm not a scientist, but I'm like saying, you've got to be kidding me. Like, I get it. So there, keep going.
Okay,
it's like,
great.
Wow.
So that's the story of the five papers in a nutshell.
Yeah, but not being able to do each one of them justice, but giving us enough touch to, you know, for me to put out hashtag what's an ocean hairball and get people
right.
to get excited about that, because I can't imagine anybody that I know that's a part of Mrs. Green's world not really wanting to listen to this and learn from it. It's just been, for a layman, extremely exciting and hopeful. So what about that question? Is the applied research what giving you hope? Can it help be, you know, be used to build predictive models? What are you going to do with all this great, vast, incredible discoveries?
Yeah, I'm really hopeful. To be honest, the fact that we could, across those organisms, saturate diversity globally for viruses, microbes, eukaryotes, it tells me that we've got this great roadmap out there for who's there.
Right.
And again, these specialists can be digging into these data for 10 years. I think the nice element is that this group is also working with modelers. And so I just hinted at the one model that helped us predict and follow one of those vortices across the South Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
These modelers are deeply involved in the planning and the interpretation of the data. From my own work, you know, only 39 of 5,476 viral populations being known, we've got new techniques and technologies that are allowing us to figure out who they are in ways and at scales never before. So while I guess you might have looked at this and said, wow, these numbers are huge, I look at it first and say the numbers are relatively constrained compared to what I expected beforehand.
Wow.
And second, I'm so delighted in many large-scale or big data analytics that we've been developing that I think patterns are going to jump out, and that really gets at, you know, ecosystem processes and drivers in ways that that allow you to scale from genes to ecosystems. This is why we founded the Ecosystem Genomic Institute. We wanted to be able to take a high-throughput sequence-based measurement like genes and be able to scale that up to what we can model or measure at the ecosystem level to understand, you know, where are the bottlenecks in this ecosystem? Is it stable? How is it going to change over time? How will it respond to perturbation? And I think we're quite close now. It's this incredibly exciting time, honestly, to be studying microbes in any system. I think we're doing it well in the oceans. There's also people who are doing it well in humans, and soils are starting to come on the forefront, and I'm sure bioreactors will start happening. So it's a really neat time.
But even in getting my head around it, there's nothing so vast as the oceans, no matter what, in the soils. We have 2 minutes left. Is that what's next for you, more research and continuing on with what you learned, and what's next?
Well, I actually finally got...
For Matthew Sullivan.
Right. I finally got some funding for Tara Ocean, so we're actually going to dive into this with a funded project.
Yes.
The funding to date has been generously provided for some high-risk methods development we did by the Moore Foundation, Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and the Joint Genome Institute, who have supported crazy ideas I've had for a long time. But we're also going to complement that ocean work by, I have seed projects now to study how microbes and viruses impact autism and how they impact human lung transplants. And so I think there's opportunity now to explore any environment where microbes are important, humans, soils, bioreactors, and oceans, of course. And I'm actively seeking collaborators who are interested in thinking about how viruses might impact those microbes they care so much about.
And I guarantee you a return spot on Mrs. Green's world. Our audiences are growing, our opportunities to learn are increasing, and the work you're doing is so important. So this will be the story of Matthew Sullivan, part one, and Tara Oceans. I mean, it's really important that work that you're up to. And I have to, before I sign off, promote our show next week. It's a woman named Bridget Alamaze, and she has a company that's on fire and equally as important in her area, Naturopod. She'll share information about why there is strong growing interest in kid and planet-friendly play and how it affects learning. Matt, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for translating it into English, and good luck on your work. Everybody, make it a great green week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.